Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And this is the month when Democrats finally begin the process of selecting the person they think would make the best president. The Iowa caucuses are a mere 2 weeks off, and then the electoral stampede begins. New Hampshire, and just a week later on to South Carolina, Arizona, Missouri, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Delaware, and beyond. This year's primary schedule moves so fast that candidates and voters will scarcely have time to breathe. This hour, we'll look past Iowa and New Hampshire to what will happen in the South and ask what this schedule on steroids might affect who gets to be the nominee, or rather how the schedule affects who gets to be the nominee. For example, do you think it's a good idea to have the Democratic nominee emerge early, months before the conventions? Does this system strengthen that candidate or make it easier for Republicans to turn them into some kind of roadkill? And voters, are they well served by having the Democratic challenger emerge early, or is more time for deliberation needed? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now let's begin the program today with a quick sense of what's happening in the campaign. Yesterday was the first debate of this election year, and as the man to beat, Howard Dean remains the center of attention, at least in the eyes of people like Lieberman, Gephardt, and Kerry.
You have the power. I'm prepared to give you the pen. Why don't you sign this agreement and open your gubernatorial records to full public view?
The Republicans tried to cut Medicare by $270 billion. At that time, you were head of the Governors Association, and you agreed with their proposal. How do you explain that position?
When you were asked by the Concord Monitor about Osama bin Laden, you said we couldn't prejudge his guilt for September 11th. What in the world were you thinking?
And just a few moments ago, I had a chance to speak with Governor Howard Dean in New Hampton, Iowa. I asked him if he felt like he was picking buckshot out of his backside.
Yes. The real front runner in this race is George Bush, not us. But I certainly appreciate the attention from my colleagues on the campaign. The only way we're going to beat George Bush is to bring new people into this party. And the only way we're going to do that is to run positive, upbeat campaigns that appeal to people who've been turned off by Washington politics. And that's exactly what we're doing.
But, you know, I watched the debate yesterday, and so much of it was focused on you. I'm curious to know what you think of what becomes of a campaign like this when so much of it is focused on a candidate such as yourself instead of Bush and the Republicans.
Well, I wish that we weren't the target of all the other attacks, but, you know, that's politics. What are you going to do? I don't think those attacks are going to be successful because people want something positive. I've always opened my stump speech by saying we're going to have a little fun at the president's expense, but we're not just going to bash George Bush. We're going to say what we would do otherwise, because if we don't have a positive program to move forward, then we don't win. And that's also true in the primary. You've got to have something positive to say. I want health insurance for every American. We're the only industrialized world, a country in the world that doesn't have it, and we can do it. I want jobs in America again. We've lost 2.9 million private sector jobs since this president's been in office. We're running $500 billion deficits every year. That's not a way to build a strong America, and we can do those things. I've done those things in my state, and we can do those things in America.
You talk a lot about Washington politics. Who are these Washington Democrats you keep criticizing?
Well, you know, they're all good people. Many of them have served in Congress for many, many years. I once added up how many years in Congress that all the folks that are running against me had served, and it came out to quite a few. But inside Washington is different than every place else in America. Outside Washington, the rules are different. People treat each other a little bit more respectfully. People tend to be pretty direct about what they believe and what they don't believe. And I think people are a good deal more civil about not making political differences into personal differences. And I think that we have lost in this country the kind of leadership that we had under people like John F. Kennedy or even Bill Clinton, where there was optimism, there was a feeling that we're all in it together. I want to put our community back together again, and this country is a big community. And worse than the loss of moral leadership we've had in the world under George Bush or in the jobs loss is the loss of our sense that we're all in this together.
But weren't Kennedy and Clinton both themselves Washington Democrats?
Well, Bill Clinton certainly wasn't. Bill Clinton came from a small state, was a successful governor there, and then became a very successful president, despite his problems, his personal problems later on. And I think that there is a long record of people coming in from the outside and cleaning up. Teddy Roosevelt was one of those people. He was governor of New York, very successful, fighting corruption, became vice president, and then ascended to the presidency when William McKinley was assassinated, and started a new day in American politics, began putting people first and attacking the enormous corporate power that had happened to take over the government in the country. And that's exactly what's happened right now. This is the third time I've seen this happen from a historical perspective. McKinley, Coolidge and Hoover, and now George Bush, where corporations are more important than ordinary Americans. We've got to put that back in balance.
Governor Dean, you've repeatedly said it's time to take back the party, or at least re-energize it. What's wrong with the Democratic Party?
George Bush came to town 500,000 votes short of Al Gore. The Democrats in Washington, not all of them, but many of them, rolled over and pretended he had a 5 million vote majority. I'll never forget when he proposed his first tax cut, $1.2 trillion. The Democratic response was, oh, no, it should be $900 billion. Now, we've lost the debate. The debate is how big should the tax cut be instead of can we afford a tax cut when we're facing one of the largest deficits in the history of the country and growing unemployment. I think that was the wrong solution. Everybody running against me, with the exception of Dennis Kucinich, voted for the war. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein's a horrible person. I'm glad we got him. But the real danger to this country is Osama bin Laden. People criticized me 2 weeks ago for saying that Saddam Hussein's capture did not make us safer. Well, today we've lost 23 more troops in Iraq. We have our commercial airliners being escorted by fighter pilots coming into the United States of America. I think that we have the wrong target in this war on terrorism, and the president ought to focus on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. These are the kinds of differences. No Child Left Behind. Now, this is the second anniversary of the passage of No Child Left Behind. This is there's some good things in this bill. It was well-intended. But the fact is it's raising property taxes all over America, and the federal government and the Republican Party has got its fingers in local school systems everywhere in America. It's costing Americans a lot of money. Ohio, Michigan, and Texas have already reduced their academic standards in order to comply with the bill. It's ridiculous. And the Democrats in Washington need to stand up against the Bush agenda and not roll over for it.
Okay, you've been praised for bringing these newcomers into the party, but at some point you have to reconcile whoever comes in with you with the people who have been there and people around the country calling themselves Democrats for years working at the grassroots level.
My experience in politics is that the public leads and the politicians follow, and I think that's what's going to happen this time. If we win the nomination, and this is a tough fight, if we win the nomination, we will bring in we think several million people that have been turned off by politics. That's going to energize our party. We need new faces and new leadership in this party if we're going to start winning elections again. And we need new people in this party to go to caucuses. We need new people. And I'm not just talking about young people, although under 30 generation has really supported us very strongly. I'm talking about people my age who've just been turned off politics because they see the Democrats and the Republicans as doing more or less the same thing.
Things are about to get very busy, what with Iowa, New Hampshire, and then leading directly into so many caucuses and primaries in the South. Is this a good thing to move that quickly, a good thing for the Democratic Party?
I don't know. I would have preferred not to have a schedule like this, but we have it, and we're fighting it, and we've planned for it. So, you know, it is what it is. The Democratic National Committee chose this schedule. Those are the rules we play by. So here we are.
Governor Dean, there are currently so many comparisons between the anti-war stand that you're taking today and George McGovern in 1972. What do you make of that comparison?
I think it's mostly spin from the other candidates and from the Republicans. I got into this race because I wanted a balanced budget and I wanted health insurance for all Americans, much of which we had done in my state of Vermont. And I think we do need change in America. I think we've got the president caters too much to big corporations and not enough to ordinary people. We're not meant to be cogs in big machines. We have spiritual values. I think I'm going to be compared to all kinds of things by the time we get done. I saw a quote from somebody in Time magazine where one of the Republican operatives said, well, you know, Howard Dean can't win. He's for gay marriage. And the reporter says, well, he pointed out that I wasn't for gay marriage. And the guy said, well, he will be by the time we get done with him. So, you know, the Republicans are going to do all their thing, and the other Democrats, while we're in this fight, are going to say their things. But in the end, I have a pretty good faith in the American people. They're going to figure out that I balance budgets, that I'm careful with money, including other people's money, and that I am determined to change this country back to a community where we respect each other again.
Okay, but the question is still there. What do you tell a Democrat who says, gee, are you going to end up like George McGovern in 72?
I'm just going to say, watch me.
Governor Dean, thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
That's Governor Howard Dean. He spoke with me just a few moments ago. I'm joined now in my Boston studio by Tom Patterson. His latest book is called The Vanishing Voter, Public Involvement in an Age of Uncertainty. Tom teaches at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Tom, it's good to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Dick.
And we're also joined on the phone by Walter Shapiro. He is political columnist for USA Today and the author of One Car Caravan, On the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In. Welcome back, Walter.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure, at least, to be here in Des Moines.
you had some expectations of what the debate yesterday might do to change the campaign. What happened?
Well, over breakfast this morning, we are now at the stage in the campaign where you do an awful lot of reporting by just going to bars and eating breakfast during breakfast time and running into people. I talked to a top dean aide who described the debate this way: no runs, no hits, no errors. And for the dean campaign, the big thing is the defensive answer: no errors. Nothing happened yesterday to derail Howard Dean on his chug to the nomination. And what's really interesting is I really wondered whether Dick Gephardt, Joe Lieberman, and John Kerry had some new line of attack holding in reserve to open up a different front against Howard Dean. And they didn't have it. It was the same old, same old. And the problem with the attacks against Dean is Lieberman is saying that he won't open records. He's Dick Cheney revisited. Gephardt is saying that Dean wants to cut Medicare, that he's Newt Gingrich revisited, and Kerry is saying he can't be trusted with national security, that he's McGovern revisited. These three images of Dean don't cohere. So it's like the charges, because they seem so scattershot, have less impact than if three candidates were all hitting Dean on one the same area.
But Tom Patterson, is it not, at this point, a push to see who is the candidate to take Dean on? They don't want us be seen as the same, do they?
Well, I think Walter has a point. You know, these attacks on Dean are not really coupled with the candidates trying to create a position for themselves. And I think that's part of the problem that those running against Dean have had, is to gain an identity as the candidate, for example, for economic change and economic recovery and jobs and the like. And ideally, what you'd like to do is to be able to find points of attack where you can also essentially put down your agenda. Instead, they've gone after kind of these soft openings that Dean, in his lack of rhetorical discipline, has provided them. But it seems to me to be a relatively weak strategy and a sort of scattershot strategy. I think Walter's right.
And Connection listeners, it's going to become particularly interesting in the weeks ahead, because once we get to New Hampshire, things begin to move so quickly that we need to focus at that time on so many primaries and caucuses which come after that. Is it the case that one person's candidacy at this point will provide so much momentum that no one else will matter? Do you, as a voter, feel like you have a chance to see what's happening from one race to the next? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we're taking something of a long view of the Democratic primary and caucus schedule this hour on the program. Everybody knows about the Iowa caucuses coming up on the 19th of this month, followed by New Hampshire on the 27th of January. What many people have not been so focused on is the fact that in the 2 weeks after New Hampshire, it's Virginia and Tennessee and Maine and Washington State and Michigan, South Carolina, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Missouri, and so on down the list. It gets so busy, it's going to be really difficult for both candidates and voters to make sense of what's going on. With me on the program today, Tom Patterson, author of The Vanishing Voter, Public Involvement in an Age of Uncertainty, and Walter Shapiro, author of a book called The One Car Caravan, On the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In. Perhaps just a little bit of history to start us off here, Tom Patterson. The whole schedule of caucuses and primaries was at one time laid out over a period of months where everybody had chance to breathe from one to the other. What happened?
Well, the changes began after the 68 election and dissatisfaction within the Democratic Party over the nomination of Humphrey. He was nominated without having participated in a single primary. And primaries had been growing in importance, and there was some sense that that was the legitimate way to get the nomination. And so the Democratic Party, through the McGovern-Fraser Commission, changed the process and mandated that states select their delegates either through a primary or through an open caucus. And states increasingly went to primaries, and initially what states did, the process was kind of backloaded in a way because states that had primaries before this stayed where they were, and most of them were in May and June. Other states that decided to hold primaries looked for an open Tuesday so that they would be sort of the center of national attention. But then you had the Carter candidacy in 1976, and he showed that momentum was the key to nomination, and states got that message pretty quickly, and so they started to move toward the front. We started to get front-loading. And then in the 80s, there was a group of southern states saying, we're not having quite enough influence on our party, and so what we're going to do is we're going to cluster, and we're going to cluster early. And that was the first Super Tuesday, was in the 1980s in the South. And then other states started to move in that direction. And you can see it in the percentage of delegates that are selected. In the 70s, you were into May before 50% of the delegates were selected. By the 80s, you were into April. And then now you're into March. So that's front-loading. That's the movement of primaries toward the beginning. What made it, what provided voters a little breathing space was a rule within the Democratic Party that there had to be a month, essentially, between the New Hampshire primary and any other primaries. But the Republican Party after 1996 decided, and they didn't have a specific rule that said that, but they had sort of followed the Democrats with that model. And the Republicans opened it up, and we had the South Carolina primary. You'll recall the Michigan primary in 2000, where that gave life to the McCain-Bush race. And Democrats after 2000 decided, well, we're gonna do away with that month as well. And so it became possible then to have your primary a week after New Hampshire. And eight states have moved into that position so that we have a really now a very much compressed calendar because of those two developments.
Now, Walter, what is the effect in terms of trying to make sense of it as an analyst, as a columnist, as a voter, as a reporter? What's wrong with the front-loading from your perspective?
Well, what's wrong with the front-loading is, God, there's so many things wrong with the front-loading. And one of the real problems we run into is that these topics only get real attention when voters say, how do we come up with this cockamamie schedule? But the problem is these schedules are locked in stone in 2001, 2002, when only a very small segment of political reporters even are paying attention. The real problem is very simply, number one, there is no voter deliberation after Iowa and New Hampshire. There's no chance to really say, wait a minute, let me think it over. You're just overwhelmed with ads, with information, as one state comes right after another. What this means is while candidates are boasting that they have visited 99 counties of Iowa, we are going to have candidates will not have time to visit any part of, say, Wisconsin that's more than 5 minutes away from a major jetport. That what you're immediately going to get after, certainly February 3rd, when South Carolina, Arizona are the big events a week after New Hampshire, is you're going to get into the flyover campaign. This means that all the candidates are going to be in the air, and on the air. It's all air all the time, mm-hmm. in the sense that it's 30-second spots. There's any interaction with the voter is only for the TV cameras, not to win votes. And that the style of personal campaigning that we've gotten used to in Iowa and New Hampshire disappears forever after this. And it's also bad for the party in the sense that a month from now, the Democrats will not know if the principal terrain they'll be fighting against Bush on is foreign policy, Iraq, and terrorism, or domestic policy, the economy, and the crony capitalism in Washington. And yet voters are going to have to make a choice in terms of which candidate is the most electable, there really isn't a sense of even what are the vulnerable aspects of the Bush presidency.
Okay, up until this point, so much of the attention has been on Iowa and New Hampshire. One of the things that we wanted to do was move ahead a little bit to just take a look at what happens next and certainly the primary that gets the most attention after New Hampshire is that in South Carolina. We've invited Whit Ayers to join us for a few moments on the program here. Whit's president of Ayers McHenry & Associates. It's a Republican polling firm based in Alexandria, Virginia. And Whit's joining us from his office there. Nice to have you back on the program, Whit.
Good to be back with you, Dick.
Tell me what we should be talking about when we turn our attention to the South. What part of the story are we missing?
Well, currently, South Carolina is a jumble. Nobody has a significant lead there. You've got Dean, Clark, Edwards, Lieberman all in the hunt. And the one to keep an eye on is Al Sharpton, because he could very well finish in the top three in South Carolina. The South Carolina Democratic primary...
What would that mean, Whit? Let me just stop you for a minute on that. If Al Sharpton showed well in South Carolina, what's that message to the party or to the candidates?
Well, I think it's that African Americans are an absolutely critical component of the Democratic Party, which will be no news to anybody. But I do think it'll be something of a shock if Al Sharpton, who has not been considered a serious candidate by anybody other than Al Sharpton up to this point, finishes in the top three, and that could very well happen. African Americans will constitute at a minimum 40% of the Democratic primary. They could constitute a majority of the Democratic primary in South Carolina. And Al Sharpton could have a very powerful message by saying, vote for me, because that's a message that we will not be taken for granted. So he could be a spoiler there. I don't think he would be a serious contender for the nomination, even if he did come in the top three, but it's one to keep an eye on.
And so if you were to try and put your finger on what it is that distinguishes South Carolina voters in that primary, what would you say?
There are two things. First is the predominance of African Americans there, where there have been virtually no primaries up to that point where African Americans have mattered very much. And the second is that the South Carolina Democratic primary is more culturally conservative than earlier Democratic primaries on issues like gay rights. They're not significantly more conservative on issues like national or tax rates and the role of government, basically economic issues, but on cultural issues they are, and that might play a role.
And Tom Patterson, are the people in South Carolina going to be making their choices, as Walter was saying, on the basis of the blizzard of ads that they've been seeing, rather than on the basis of actually being able to see the candidates, go to hear them speak?
Well, I think both things will play a part. I mean, one of the things about front-loading is that money is important, and it's much more important than it was in the old system. Not since 1984 has the winner of the nominating race been anyone but the candidate who raised the most money prior to the first contest, prior to Iowa. That gives you a sense of what Iowa, what money means, and that's advertising. But the candidates have been on the ground in South Carolina,
right?
Not as much as in Iowa and in New Hampshire, but they've been on. They understand. There are six primaries the week after New Hampshire, but the media is focusing on South Carolina. That's going to be the important one. That's going to be the big story.
Do you agree with that? Is it the best of the bunch to look at in terms of trying to find an indicator for what comes next?
Well, it has a little more history than the other primaries, and that's part of it. But it's also in the Eastern time zone. In terms of news, that makes a difference,
yeah.
Right? And it was important in 2000 in the McCain-Bush race. So
right.
I think there's a kind of some natural reasons, if not theoretical ones, why the press is looking at South Carolina. It's kind of to Dean's disadvantage. He'll come out of New Hampshire. You wouldn't like state in the South to be the next big contest. And then looking a week after South Carolina, we have Tennessee and Virginia. So if the race is going to open up, if some candidate is going to emerge as the alternative to Dean, I think it will happen in that two-week window.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida for our first call. Randy's joining us. Hi, Randy. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I was just... me, when I saw the debates last night, the thing that really stood out to me is that here the Democrats are all attacking each other and picking on each other, instead of distinguishing themselves individually by what they would do that would be good and right, you know, not by knocking down the other guy. And, you know, they have a hard enough job of getting this bad president out of office. And if they're going to do a good job, they need to quit making themselves look bad in front of the public. Because I think people looking at it are kind of just saying, well, tell me something positive about yourself. Don't tell me something negative about Dean or somebody else, you know.
Walter, you've written about Edwards as the sunny side up candidate, somebody who is trying to present himself as not necessarily negative in the way that Randy is describing it, but it's not winning him any real measurable support at this point.
Well, the key word is measurable. We are it is impossible to poll for the Iowa caucuses, and New Hampshire voters are notoriously volatile. And as Whit Ayers was pointing out, no candidate right now in South Carolina has much more than a sixth of the vote. And nowhere else in the country are Democrats yet paying attention. So we can be a little overwhelmed by the polls. That said, Edwards has a long way to go in a very short amount of time. And I thought he had a very good night last night. I thought that this was a debate. If there was a single winner, it probably was John Edwards, and there was a couple of times in a very nicely phrased, not nasty, encounters with Dick Gephardt where you can just see Edwards, the courtroom attorney, just eating Gephardt's lunch with the big smile on his face. But the real problem, going back to what the caller was saying, is that in a limited amount of time, what you're trying to do is not talk about your vision for the, environmental regulation under your presidency. You're really trying to land a punch against Howard Dean, for the most part, the front runner. And it's also the blurriness is that, for the most part, the Democrats agree more than they disagree on domestic policy, where Iraq, which is receding, the question of should we go into war is receding as an issue, even though Iraq, of course, is a dominant issue. And Iraq is still the only place where there were real major cleavages in the Democratic Party.
Let me hear just a bit from Whit Ayers here. Whit, we're talking about measurable support and the sort of traditional reliance on the polls. Does that fall apart when everything gets compressed as it is?
What's going to govern the winner in South Carolina is what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire. It is a jumble right now, but we underestimate Howard Dean's strength at our peril here. As Tom said, the candidate who raises the most money wins the nomination. Howard Dean has raised the most money. If Howard Dean knocks off Gephardt in Iowa, where Gephardt was initially favored, if he knocks off Kerry in New Hampshire, where Kerry was initially favored, he will have an enormous head of steam going into South Carolina. And I think he's very likely to win the South Carolina primary as well, Yankee or not, if he wins those first two states.
Tom Patterson, you've talked about this compression of primaries as leading to something that you call the silent spring. Is this that momentum, however it is constructed through a rush of primaries and caucuses, simply can't be maintained through to the conventions?
Well, I think you can't hold the public's attention through to the convention. Look, in 2004, in early March, when 2004's Super Tuesday occurs, and there'll be 12 states holding their contests on that date. We'll be well over 50% of the delegates will have been selected. And in all likelihood, we'll have the Democratic nominee in hand. But that's early March, and we're talking late July before we hit the conventions. And essentially, the public, once the contests end, they'll stay in there for a week or two, but then it really slows down. The news coverage slows down, and people's interest, frankly, in the campaign dissipates. And that's the silent spring. I mean, that's essentially the time where voters begin to vacate the arena. And it opens up the possibility, as Clinton found out, about in 96, if you've got a lot of money and your opponent doesn't, you have an opportunity in that period to kind of really tear at whoever the nominee of the other party is.
And Whit Ayers, is that what the Republicans are planning on doing with the candidate?
I don't think you could classify that as the Republican strategy now, Dick. I think they'll have a positive vision for the future and talk about what the role of the world ought to be. And
stop
and
reading from your prepared script here.
let me just say that Howard Dean is not shy about providing ammunition to opposing candidates. He's willing to say some things that are truly breathtaking, and I suspect will be resurrected in the fall if he's the nominee.
Walter Shapiro, some people have gone so far as to suggest that Howard Dean, should he become the candidate, could in fact show up in Boston in late July so bloodied that the convention suddenly takes on new meaning. Do you think that that's a possibility?
Well, I have always, sick puppy that I am, in covering all of these presidential races, dreamed of seeing a second ballot at a convention in my lifetime. But that said, the front-loading, which is so self-defeating for the Democratic Party, and if there is anything that should be laid at the feet of Terry McAuliffe and the leaders of the party, it is this schedule. Because to a large extent, even in 1992, it was a leisurely pace. Bill Clinton didn't wrap up the nomination of the California primary in June. And by wrapping up a nomination in June, you take a couple of weeks off to regroup. Then it's time to pick your vice president. There was something for the candidate to do. In 1996, confronted with the silent spring, Bob Dole, after forlornly wandering around the country, could think of nothing to do other than to resign from the Senate he loved. In 2000, while Al Gore made a stirring comeback after he picked Lieberman and after the Democratic convention, I don't think there was one human being who opted for Al Gore between the time of his putting away Bill Bradley and the Democratic convention.
All right. I have to stop you there and take this moment to thank Whit Ayers for being with us. Whit, always great to have you on the program.
Good to be with you, Dick.
Whit is president of Ayers, McHenry & Associates, a Republican polling firm based in Alexandria, Virginia. Connection listeners, do you think it is a good idea to have a Democratic nominee emerging as early as he might in this particular race, months before the convention? Does it strengthen the candidate, or does it simply provide too much fodder for the opposition? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what you're making of this process, the Democratic Party, to choose its candidate for the president, and the rush of primaries and caucuses that are soon to be upon us. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Walter Shapiro is with us from Des Moines, Iowa. He is a political columnist for USA Today. Tom Patterson is here with me in the studio. He's a professor at the Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. We're going to Salem, Massachusetts now, and Carlotta, you're next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello, it's Carlotta, and thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in having your discussion include what's been recently identified as a significant Democratic voting bloc, and that is single women with discretionary money, the independence to vote their minds, and pocketbook impact of Bush, and I happen to be one of them, and I've dedicated all of my discretionary money right now to a Democratic candidate.
And your question is whether or not this group of women is emerging as a force in the campaign, or whether or not people...
This block of women is being identified as a significant part of the Democratic electorate.
Right.
And I want to hear that included in your discussions.
Tom, we have spoken in the past about soccer moms and NASCAR dads, and Carlotta's bringing our attention to another block of voters. At this point in the process, are the candidates, is the party identifying where it needs to target its attention?
Well, the media tend to do this. I mean, they tend to create something like soccer moms and focus a lot of attention on it. And it has, I think, it says something about the electorate. But I think the fundamental fact about primaries is that they it's a different electorate for the primary election than for the general election. Most obviously, it's much smaller. We get, you know, about half the people vote in the general election, barely more than 20% in the primaries. But it's the core. It's the core of the party. And when you look at that core, on the Democratic side, it's somewhat more liberal. On the Republican side, it's somewhat more conservative. And the Democratic constituency this time, I think Howard Dean has a lock on the anti-war block within that. And what's more open, I think, are those who are concerned about domestic issues, education, health, and the like. And I think, you know, the single woman that she's talking about is in that category. Although also, when you look at the difference between men and women, women are much less supportive of the use of military force abroad. So, you know, They're in among the groups that the candidates are looking at, but I think the major fact is that, you know, this is a smaller, more activist, more intense set of voters than you find in the general election.
Walter, I think you were writing in one of your chapters about how some 60,000 of the Iowa Democrats actually get involved in the primaries when so many hundreds of thousands could.
This is one of the big distinctions between Iowa and New Hampshire. In my book, One Car Caravan, I think I calculated that 70% of the New Hampshire voters who voted in the presidential election in November 2000 also voted in the Democrat or Republican primaries. In contrast, in Iowa, which really was the benchmark moment for deciding between Gore and Bradley, in 2000, only 61,000 of 500,000 registered Iowa Democrats came to a caucus. And this also means why it is so hard to poll. Because in 1988, a little over 100,000 attended a caucus. In 2000, it was 60,000. People confidently say 120,000, 150,000 people will be attending the caucuses, but nobody knows. That there have only been two contested caucuses in the Democratic Party in Iowa in the last 20 years, 1988 and 2000, because Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, was on the ballot in 92, so nobody challenged him here. And Clinton was unopposed in 96. So it is real. Not only is this limited to party activists, but you don't know which party activists will actually come. I was with John Edwards here earlier in the week in Iowa, and a 61-year-old construction supervisor who I saw in Edwards' speech said he really liked Edwards. I said, so you'll definitely caucus for him? He said, well, if I could figure out this caucus process. The guy has lived in Iowa all of his life. He has never gone to a caucus. And while he likes Edwards, it's very hard to count him as a probable participant, a possible participant, or someone who will never get to a caucus if he hasn't gotten to one already. And that is why anyone looking at polls, particularly out of Iowa, they are the crudest possible blunderbuss measuring device.
All right. Let's go back to the lines to St. Clair, Michigan now, and Stephen's joining us. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm beginning to feel like we're looking back at the 2004 election, which is to say that the media seems to have already picked Howard Dean as the candidate and seems to have already decided that George Bush has beaten him. And I believe that there has to be a point at which, report that which is news. But the more you speculate and the more you the more it becomes Howard Dean and everybody else, the more it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So, Stephen, would you have polls kept out of any kind of reporting? How do you get away from the sort of desire to try and measure who's doing well? Because that's sort of where we end up, isn't it?
Well, again, I think that reporting the polls
right
is one thing. And I guess it's important to know who's doing well, but I guess that needs to be, in my opinion, secondary to actually what the candidates' positions and different things are.
Tom, I know that you've done some writing about the way that the media influences. What would you say to Stephen about the idea that we've already decided what the race is going to look like and who's going to win?
Well, the media love to handicap, so that, you know, that's always going to be a story. But I think there's a dynamic that occurs in these nominating races, and that is when one candidate begins to sort of move forward, to move to the top, the press, you know, picks up on that candidate, but also begins to kind of bite on the edges, bite the heels of the candidate. And then at the level of the voter, there's a tendency for voters to kind of rally around someone else, the anybody but candidate. And we saw that, for instance, in 1976 when Jimmy Carter broke out. Other Democrats who weren't happy with Carter had to find someone to be the un-Carter. Turned out to be Jerry Brown. Now, he jumped into the race as governor of California after the race had started. And head-to-head, he beat Carter every time, but it was too late. We saw the same thing in 1984 when Mondale looked from, and the press perspective was, Mondale's got this nomination, so he got it locked up. Hart became the un-Mondale, and other Democrats then flocked to the Hart candidacy, and of course he beat Mondale in New Hampshire. So I think some of that's going to happen. If you look at the candidates who could be the recipients of that response from the electorate, it's likely to be Clark, Edwards, or Gebhardt. It's likely to occur in South Carolina. And then again, we have this scheduling fluke because, you know, this is a haphazard scheduling mm-hmm. process, that right after South Carolina, the next week, we go into Tennessee and Virginia. And so if one of those candidates could beat Dean in South Carolina or nearly beat Dean, then we might see a repeat of that the following week. And then the press will be saying, of course, this is a wide-open race. And that won't necessarily be true either, because if Dean's got all the money, right. Then we go to Wisconsin and then on to Super Tuesday, and then it becomes predictable
again. Walter, I sort of feel like I should be mailing Stephen a copy of that column that you wrote about, let's let the voters decide.
Exactly. It's because, you know, while Dean does have a substantial lead, as Tom just pointed out, this is far from a done deal. And there is too much in our culture, too many TV shows that reward predictions, too much glibness, that we live in a world of pseudo-certainty, with the emphasis on the word pseudo. And many things can happen. And no candidate has ever romped to the nomination in modern times unmolested by reality. Not George W. Bush, backed by every governor in the world in 2000. Not Walter Mondale, backed by the entire party establishment in 1984. Not even Jimmy Carter, incumbent president in 1980. So, I mean, the idea that, as in the parlance, that Howard Dean is just going to sweep the table, it is possible, but if so, it would be pretty unprecedented.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina now. And David, you're with us. Go ahead.
Wondering, you know, we've got the two big things everybody's focusing on in Iowa and New Hampshire, and it's certain that, you know, nine or not even the six so-called serious candidates are going to come out of there with still a real chance. And I'm wondering, how many people do the experts that we're talking to right now think can come into February still having a realistic chance? And then will the other candidates stay in the race, and what kind of impact would that have if some of the other candidates, maybe a Lieberman or an Edwards or a Kerry or whoever, has been knocked off by what's already happened? If he stays in the race, what impact does that have on the people who really are still trying to catch Dean?
So can I simplify this down to what's going to happen after Iowa and New Hampshire? How many people might drop out in those first two?
Right, and if they don't drop out, you know, if Kerry doesn't do well in New Hampshire, whatever that means,
yeah,
then he doesn't have a chance. If he doesn't drop out, does that make it harder for the other candidates to make a real run at Dean?
Walter, can you make some sense of this for us?
Yeah, it's a terrific point raised by the caller. And, yeah, the more candidates are on the field, on the stage in every debate and on television, the harder it is for someone to emerge as the anti-Dean. What really will dictate things is the candidates' fundraisers. if Dick Gephardt loses badly in Iowa, his fundraisers will probably tell him, we just can't raise any more money. Kerry, who could lose to Dean in New Hampshire, is a little more problematical in the sense that he is now mostly funding his own campaign. So in theory, if there's more real estate jointly owned with his wife to borrow against, Kerry could persevere on until the February 3rd states and perhaps clutter them up, even if he finishes badly in Iowa and New Hampshire. Lieberman and Edwards don't have the money to go on beyond the seven events on February 3rd, unless they do well on February 3rd. And Wesley Clark has raised a lot, but is spending a lot. And at this moment, Clark is even more virulent on the subject of Iraq than Howard Dean. So it gets harder and harder to envision Clark as the alternative for Democrats who think that Dean is too outspoken to be an effective nominee.
Tom, what about that? What about the idea that Walter puts forward that Clark and Dean are in fact too much of a muchness, that Clark could appear as the un-Dean or the anti-Dean?
Well, no, I think Walter has a good point. And, you know, when you look at this process, it's sometimes said about Iowa that it thins the field, that's its role, that it tells you who the also-rans are, and that New Hampshire bestows momentum on the winner and oftentimes the person who comes in second. But I think there's a wild card in this race, and Whit Ayers made reference to Al Sharpton in South Carolina. Sharpton is not likely to do at all well in Iowa and New Hampshire, so you'd think, well, he's out of the race. But he may well stay in the race because he's appealing to a particular constituency. And if he does well among African-American voters in South Carolina, then you have to ask the question, who did he hurt? You know, essentially, where were those votes taken from? And that could well affect, if they come from Edwards, that could give Clark an opportunity in South Carolina to come to the forefront as the challenger to Dean.
We will have a chance, in fact, to listen to more of all the candidates. That's in the only radio debate of the election season. That's tomorrow from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Talk of the Nation, hosted by Neil Conan. Tom Patterson, I want to thank you for coming in and joining us on the program today.
Dick, thank you.
Tom is author of The Vanishing Voter, Public Involvement in an Age of Uncertainty. Walter Shapiro, thanks for joining us again.
I enjoy it, as always.
Walter Shapiro is political columnist for USA Today and author of One Car Caravan on the Road with the 2004 Democrats Before America Tunes In. Also on the program, we had a chance to speak with Whit Ayers, president of Ayers McHenry & Associates, Republican polling firm based in Alexandria, Virginia, and Governor Howard Dean. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.